to another edition of Summer is Coming. I'm your host, Tiny Grimes, and I'm joined this week by...
Dark Nudge.
So, we apologize for the long layoff we had. Basically, there was the holidays, and to be honest, Game of Thrones hasn't been all that exciting of a place to be the last month or two, with no new chapter packs on the horizon, nothing different about the meta. Star Wars has been out. I don't know if anyone has noticed. I have a Star Wars podcast called The Smuggler's Den that you can check out. But with regional season approaching, Dark Nudge and I are back and committed to bringing you some useful information.
So as we prep for that regional season, one of the things that we always, at least I always, take time to do is look back on the last year and say, what were the top three decks? Why were they the top three? And are they going to continue to be the top three in the coming regional season? And I think Tiny will agree with me. If we look back at the top decks, we see Targ, whether it's the House of Pain, which is the Knights of the Hollow Hill 2-2-2 deck, or Targ Maesters. Then we see a Greyjoy Maester build, which took Europe by storm. And then finally, we see a Stark Kill, and whether that's Stark Knights, like the overall world champion played in the Joust, or a more traditional Stark Winter, which was what basically the DC meta took to Worlds. It's a very strong deck. Would you agree with that top three, Tiny?
If we have the caveat that we're talking about the end of the season at Worlds and not the entirety of last year, I definitely agree that at Worlds, Targ and Stark were the two biggies. Greyjoy was not that great, but then at Stalik we saw some resourceful people come up with some answers for how one would handle Targ. Because I know going into Worlds, I loved what Greyjoy Maesters looked like, but I knew Bruno's deck, we tested it, and I thought, oh my goodness, anyone who brings Greyjoy Maesters is just going to get slaughtered. It's just a dead deck. Greyjoy as a whole is dead. Targ erases all the saves. But lo and behold, some creative souls came up with a good answer.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
one question that I would have for you, Dark Nudge, is why do you think Martell is not in that top three? I mean, it has all these amazing events. It has all these amazing characters. It has so much control. Why is it not in this select group of decks?
I think a bunch of it has to do with actually the current meta. Martell is still, a lot of Martell decks are still a top tier deck. It's just when you start looking at things like Martell Summer, it has a horrible matchup against the Stark Winter, obviously. When you start to look at things like Martell Maesters, which was an excellent archetype, again, it doesn't have a great matchup against the Stark Winter with, Mirror Blanking two things, getting rid of a lot of your chains, all those kill events to kill your Maesters. And also, it has a poor matchup, actually, versus the Greyjoy Maesters. Because of all their cancels, they're able to basically render a bunch of those great Martell events useless. And because of that, it's still a nice top-tier deck. But it's not going to be the one that's going to, win these huge tournaments like the European Championship or Worlds in the States.
Yeah, and another big problem, at least for me, is the Iron Throne. That card just wrecked so much of what Martell is trying to do. If you're relying on the Viper's Bannerman or the Orphans, it just cancels whatever it is you're trying to do. And you might be saying, well, what about he calls it thinking? Yeah, that's true, but the Iron Throne is repeatable. That's what makes it so amazing.
Yeah, and when, a lot of these responses that you use, Viper's Bannerman that you named and some of the other things are actually draw effects for Martell. So if you start using cards to get your draw, it's like you're drawing less. So either way, even if you're, he calls it thinking every single time someone uses the Iron Throne, you're still losing that card that you could have used to cancel something else or use it a different response. So it just makes that draw that much less effective. And I think that's one of the big reasons that you see a lot of the Martell players saying, oh no, it's a Lannister player, because you can almost guarantee there's going to be two Iron Thrones in almost any Lannister deck.
Yeah, I agree. It's gotten to the point for me where in my Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill decks, I just play the Iron Throne. I mean, it's a phenomenal card anyway, and then if I'm playing a Lannister deck, it doesn't just completely crush me for the whole game. Now, having said that Martell isn't quite in this top three decks, I won't be at all surprised, actually, if during regional season someone is able to resurrect a Martell deck. It just has so many amazing characters that I could easily see Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill being in this group of three. Martell Macers could come back. Maybe even a Martell Summer deck, although I'm more hesitant on that since I think a lot of people will still be playing Winter.
Yeah, I definitely think it's on the cusp, but it's definitely not one of the top three decks. And actually, if I'm being really specific, I would say, you know, Maesters really holds a lot of this these top three deck slots. You know, definitely Greyjoy Maesters, definitely Targ Maesters. So two out of three, you're looking at a very strong recipe. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that the Targ Maesters is probably a better deck overall than the Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill.
Yeah, I've seen some really strong builds. The difference for me is that Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill plays differently every game. It's less predictable. It's more difficult for your opponent to beat, and it gives the good player more options to make pro plays. Whereas Targ Maesters is much more about, here's my Maester, he's chained up. If you can handle him somehow, say, Stark Murder, getting one of those murder events through, I'm going to have a lot more difficulty. Whereas Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill, there's no one card, there's no two cards, there's no five cards you can just take out and win. It's just a matter of handling it in its entirety.
Yeah, it definitely has some, we'll say, drawbacks. It's things like certain plots can really mess with it. But overall, it is definitely a deck that allows for, like you were saying, the good player to have so much more maneuverability. It's not like, you know, Stark Siege or a lot of the other Maester decks where it's, you know, do X, do Y, do Z 95% of the time. I agree with that. It doesn't necessarily make it a better deck. It actually means that for, you know, your beginner or intermediate players, it's actually a very difficult deck to pilot.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting deck because it seems fairly easy. And I've seen a lot of intermediate players win with the deck because basically it crushes any non-tier 1 deck. If somebody just throws out some random tier 2 deck, the Knights of the Hollow Hill is going to crush it with almost anyone piloting it. The real trick is piloting it against other good players with other good decks. It actually is a difficult deck to pilot well. What do you think about Greyjoy Winter? I actually think that Greyjoy Winter might also be in that list. The only reason I don't have it there is because I think Greyjoy Maester is just straight up better than it.
I totally agree. I mean, we saw some interesting Greyjoy choke builds that used Maesters as well come. So you can, you know, it's just because you're running Maesters doesn't mean you can't run Winter as well in the same build. And we saw some of those, and some of those went really far in the European tournaments. We saw one in a European tournament get 8th at Shalik. But overall, I think you're almost always better going the Maester route out of Greyjoy.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to agree with that for now. I have a Greyjoy Winter deck that I really liked, and I was thinking about making it my primary deck until I saw this new variant of Greyjoy Maesters. And frankly, I didn't love the build that was coming out of Europe, but the idea of the build I liked a lot, and with some tweaking, I'm currently much more happy with the Maester build than the Winter build. And the difference is really as simple as this. When you have a non-Maester deck, you're going into a game hoping that your deck has the appropriate answers. And if it's a Tier 1 deck, it probably does. But when you're playing a Maester deck, you know that it does. No matter what they're doing, you just open your chain toolbox and pull out the chain you need. Oh, they have one guy that they're relying on? Okay, I'll use the lead link on him every single turn. Oh, they're relying on Cersei to put through an intrigue? I'll steal her intrigue challenge every time. And to me, that's the big difference between a Greyjoy Winter straight up and a Greyjoy Maester that might use Winter.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the powers of all the Maester builds is this toolbox effect. And there still isn't these huge cards that totally demolish the Maesters. You know, Nightmares is out there, yes. Mirror is out there, yes. But Greyjoy has so much cancel that they can really control those type of, you know, things that are normally just horrible for other Maester decks are pretty meh to the Greyjoy player normally.
Yep. And what about Lannister? I keep building a Lannister deck, and I keep thinking, this is so close to being in this mix of top decks, and then every time I think it gets close, I play a few games and I realize it's just not quite there. What's your evaluation of Lannister?
I feel like that too, but I mean, there's got to be something to Lannister. Greg Ackerson played Lannister. He's a top tier player. He took it to fourth at Worlds. You know, maybe it's a play style. Maybe, I don't know what it is. I agree with you. I can't personally make a tier one Lannister deck that's beaten all comers right now. Now, that being said, I think they're so close that when we, you know, hopefully the first couple chapter packs is going to have some Lannister cards, and that'll tip them back into the tier one and make them really competitive again. Because when Fantoshi Manitor came out, it really pushed them so close. And now if they just get one or two cards that, you know, either relate to their Neil theme well, or relate to their, you know, semi-dominance theme or their gold theme well or something like that, that could just push them into that competitive level with the other top decks.
Yeah, it feels to me like the difference between, say, Lannister and Martell is Lannister has all the great control cards, just like Martell. It has great events, maybe not quite as good as Martell, but it's that character base. It just doesn't measure up to Martell. So it's basically, when I look at the two decks, it's the same theme, only Martell has slightly better events and much better characters, and that to me is where the difference comes in.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I really think that Lannister, you know, when I think of the great Lannister characters, I think of less than five. When I think of the great Martell characters, I start to go, oh, okay, that's seven, that's eight, that's, you know, I quickly have a large number of them.
Yeah, for me, when I think of the great Lannister characters, I think of probably two.
It's Stellan of the Rock and Cersei?
We'll say three because I put the Jaime that stands at the beginning of each phase in there as well, even though he probably wouldn't fit in there for any other house. It's just Lannister is so desperate that I'm willing to say he's a good Lannister character.
Well, they have Shadow Tyrion, who's absolutely fantastic. One of the best Shadow cards out there.
Yeah, see, I don't like Shadows Tyrion that much, unless I'm running a heavy Shadows deck, and usually I'm not when I'm running Lannister. Just as a one-off out of Shadows, I feel like he's a bit expensive for what he is. He's a good character, but I wouldn't put him in that great character status.
I agree as a one-off, but I think if you're using him, then you're going to have at least a small Shadow sub-theme, and when you do have that, he is just absolutely fantastic. He can be a beast in the Shadows deck.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree with that.
But yeah, once you know, we're looking at four characters now, and then when I start to think of other good characters in Lannister deck, I start actually looking at other houses. I start looking at out of house Asha.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously they're missing that character base. And the thing that really jumps out is that I can't think of a single chud that I say, oh, this is really good. I can't think of, you know, a spearman or anything like that, or, you know, a boatswain or something that says, wow, this is really good, low cost, super high efficient character that I would put in all my decks.
Yeah, it seems to me the closest things they have are the painted dogs, and there are two, and that's really a whole nother category. And then all those gold weenies, which are nice, but they're basically just gold to help you get out the more expensive characters. And since we just said there aren't that many phenomenal, really expensive characters, suddenly their value goes down.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think that's one of the things that's holding them. And then I guess the last house to talk about is Baratheon.
I don't think we need to talk about Baratheon. They're not good. The end.
I think there's definitely some strong rush builds out of Baratheon, and I think the European-style one that uses Blockade and Fear of Winter can be extremely effective. You know, they have First Snow in there as well. It can be surprisingly fast. It's surprisingly resilient because you normally run knights with it. So it can do all right, but the problem is there's no surprise with Baratheon. Every other house has some event that's surprising. Baratheon, I feel like you lay down your cards and say, my surprise is I got an extra dude out this round.
Yeah, and really the surprise is often I got three extra guys out this round. But most decks have a way to control your big important guys. It's just how the meta works right now. If you're playing against Lannister or if you're playing against Martell, they're going to have a way to control those guys. They're not just going to go, oh, darn, you got out Knight of Flowers and the new Stannis. Oh, man, you just grabbed 8 power. That's what it looks like in a vacuum when you build the deck. You go, oh, this deck's going to be amazing. I can win turn 1 40% of the time and turn 2 the other 60% of the time. And then you play an actual game and you go, oh, that's right, all my guys got controlled. I guess I never get to win with this deck.
Yeah, or my Knight of the Flowers that just got, you know, 3 power on him just got killed from a kill event. Or,
One of my favorites, of course, is just Hatchling's Feast on him. And then you kill all those guys with Renowned that had power on him, and boom, now they have to start over. But you're right. That deck is actually really strong against random tier 1.5, tier 2 decks. So it's not to say that Baratheon is worthless and no one should play it. It's just when you get into the ultra-efficient tier 1, not even tier 1, but the top part of the tier 1 decks, Baratheon just doesn't make that cut.
Because I would definitely say that Baratheon European style is a tier 1 deck. It does well against a large variety of other tier 1 decks like Stark Murder. It just starts to falter when it runs into Martell and Lannister.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would fully agree with you just because I haven't playtested it enough, but in theory, that does sound accurate.
So we talked about, you know, we just basically ranked all the houses now and talked about some of the, their major deck archetypes. But let's get back to the top three that we were talking about and, you know, what really changed to put them ahead of the others. For instance, the Targ Knight of the Hollow Hill deck we talked about, what were the key cards that brought it from, you know, maybe the bottom of the tier one builds to the top of the tier one builds this year? For me, I think it was Long Lancers. Like, that completely changed Targ in the meta in my mind.
Yeah, for me, it's half that and it's half redundancy. The fact that you no longer have to play cards like Lady Daenerys Chambers and then play Dragon Skull and Flame Kiss and totally rely on them and rely on recurring them. Now that you don't have to do that anymore, because there's more options. You can do Incinerate, you can do Flame Kiss, you can keep kneeling and standing the street waves to recur them that way. It just feels like there's more redundancy in the deck than there ever has been.
Right, and that had to come about from certain key cards, and I think you mentioned some of them, like Incinerate definitely changed the meta for Targ. And, you know, the reason that Street Wave is standing over and over again is because of those Long Lancers again. So we're seeing basically what you said, that now that Targ's got kind of a card pool that's large enough that does similar effects, you no longer have to rely on drawing your one of three of that key event. And if they stopped it and you weren't able to recurse it after that, you were in big trouble. Well, now, you know, you have a much higher chance, probability of drawing the event you need, and you have a much higher chance of being able to recurse it once it's been used.
Yeah, and then the other huge card for me was Recruitment. The fact that a lot of really strong Targ cards are allies or mercenaries means that even if you do get rid of that Street Wave, say they use it 3 times and they give you 3 cards back and you say, thank goodness, I'm just going to Valor both of them off the table. I don't have to worry about them anymore. They play 2 Recruitments, they get them both back, they play a Long Lances, and there, it's all started again.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that goes to, so really, we're saying the top 3 cards are Recruitment, Incinerate, Long Lancers, and those 3 cards alone completely changed Targaryen from what would have been probably close to the bottom of the Tier 1 decks up to what I think is very close to the top.
I would even throw more cards into there. I mean, they got so many amazing cards this time. Company of the Cat is another one of these cards that you now have more ambush guys. It's more redundancy on the ambush. So you can play a deck that's really heavy ambush and not have to worry about having characters on the table. Then along with that, you have the Great Pyramid of Meereen, which is just another influence location. Like I said, more redundancy. You're not relying on drawing these handful of cards. There's just more different cards that do the same thing that you can draw.
So I think I totally agree with the Pyramid of Meereen. However, I'm not so sure about Company of the Cat. If we look at a lot of the top tier Maester decks, they don't include it. And a lot of the you know, Knights of the Hollow Hill deck aren't using more than one copy, if any at all, as well.
That's interesting. I know Bruno's deck used three, and in my current build, which I haven't looked at in much detail lately, it uses three as well, just because it's an amazing character. You get draw out of it. You can do really cool tricks where you play Ambush from the Plains to drop it in. You draw a card. It goes back to your hand. You ambush it in next time. You draw another card. It dies. You play Recruitment. You draw a card. So I'm frankly a little bit surprised that he's not in these decks. Now, I wouldn't put it in a Maester deck because trying to have that much influence and Maesters isn't going to go that well. But in a Knights of the Hollow Hill deck, for me, it's a pretty essential card.
I don't personally play the Knights of the Hill version of Tark, so I don't have much to say on that. But the other ones that I've seen posted around or that have won some tournaments have not included it. I know that for sure.
I think we can say with confidence that they built bad decks.
And they're still winning tournaments.
Because that's how good Targ is. No, I'm just kidding. It might be a fine deck, but in my personal opinion, I can't see myself not running Company of the Cat.
Yeah, I think their theory was that it just got squeezed out by other key cards like Incinerate or like Thundering Cavalry.
Yeah, and that's fair. But we'll have to agree to disagree for the moment. One more card we didn't mention that really could go in any amazing deck is Much and More. And this is another card that smooths out that redundancy. You can include less of the cards you need, knowing you can play Much and More to cycle through and see more of your deck to get to those cards. So really, in summary, I think for Targ, it's redundancy. They've gotten so many cards that do the same thing that you can actually rely on them happening. I remember I tried to build a Targ burn deck before all these new cards, and half the time it was amazing, and half the time it was a total debacle because I just wouldn't draw the cards I needed.
I think when we look at the next house, which in my mind is the Stark Kill, the next deck, sorry, not the next house, we start to see the same type of theme. It's redundancy. What really pushed, in my mind, Stark Kill to the next level was two big cards. I think Mira gave them an answer to almost everything, which gave them so much more control than they've had in the past. And then second, they got another kill event. And now, instead of having to use just Die by the Sword, they now have the ability to kill that many more characters, make sure they draw those key kill events, and basically destroy your opponent's board.
Yeah.
Do you agree with, yeah?
Yeah, I totally agree. And the funny thing is I don't consider those new cards because they were in the cycle before, but you're right. Those two cards have really shaped the meta. You don't have to rely on putting in tons of Warcrest characters now because Stark already has all of these amazing, unique characters. So all you need is a unique character, and you can pull off...
No Quarter.
You can pull off your No Quarter, and then you throw in a handful of the other Warcrest characters. Maybe you run two Die by the Swords instead of three, or maybe you go the full boat and run three. And yeah, you just have all these different options for kill, and Mira's just amazing. I mean, she really pushes them over by giving them that control. And they also got other just solid good characters this year. Sir Kyle Condon, I'm going to have to apologize. I said he wasn't that good. And then I started playing it more, and I realized the one thing that crushes Stark is a well-timed Valor. But if you can have Kyle out, Mira in Shadows, Arya out, Jory Castle with his dupe on him, you can't Valor the deck. So you Valor, big deal. They get all their guys back next turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And that ability to actually get some saves out of Stark is one of the things that I think also drove them up the food chain to a position of strength for this year. Now, do you think that Stark will actually be start to lose some of its shine in the coming regional season, Tiny, or do you think it's going to stay up there along with Targ?
That's kind of hard to say. I think it's going to stay up there just because there isn't enough new stuff that beats it. One of the beauties of Stark is no one really techs to beat it. It's never the best deck. It's always the deck that handles the best decks really well because it's toolboxy. If you use Winner especially and you use Mira, you can do tricks. It's more of a meta answer, I think, than a target. And because of that, I think it has staying power.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the introduction of the Bastard Boys really adds some more punch to Stark as well. And I think we'll see a lot of play from them in top tier decks soon.
Yeah, I've actually altered my Stark builds. I don't play at the gates anymore because Bastard Boys is so strong. So I've gone up to, I've started using Manning the City Walls. I've gone up to 3 Northern Cavalry Flanks, 2 Bastard Boys, a couple Riders of the Red Fork. So I'm able to pump in that amazing army first turn. And if you get Bastard Boys first turn, can put them in for free with Manning the City Walls, you can get a really good stranglehold on the game right from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very strong card, and it will have a huge impact on the meta.
Another thing we didn't mention for Stark about why it's so good now is that you can run 6 two-claim plots, and you can run 6 good two-claim plots. The insertion of Men of Pride, Manning the City Walls, these two plots have really changed things. Breaking and Entering is a reasonable choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I totally agree with you. Before, you know, they'd have one or two claim plots, and the rest would just be filler. Now they're able to really keep that constant pressure down on their opponent, and that once they get ahead, it's so hard for your opponent to draw enough characters to actually keep some on the board.
Yeah, I agree. It's really brutal once you've realized what's happening. When your opponent plays that first two claim plot, and you go, okay. Then the next one comes. Now your board is pretty cleared. Then the next one comes. It starts dawning on you, wait, if I play a character, it dies. What exactly am I supposed to do here?
Yeah, absolutely. It's even scarier when they're hitting your hand, too. So it's like, well, I can either play the character, it's going to die, or I can keep it in my hand, and he's going to make me discard it. Yeah, and it's that constant pressure.
What about Bear Island? I know I was under the impression that there was going to be a really amazing House of Dreams Bear Island deck, and a lot of other people were. Where do you stand on it now? Do you think there's going to be one for regional season?
I've played with it a bit, and personally, I don't think it's tier one. I think it's just shy. If they can deal with that Bear Island earlier, you gave up so much if you're set up. You gave up your agenda slot, which Stark has some great agendas that go with it. I just don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, I think for me, the biggest problem is that if Maesters are going to be big, it can't kill any of the guys with chains on them. And if something like Greyjoy Maesters is going to be big, you're not going to be able to kill those guys with your kill events either, because they're going to cancel them. And then if you try to Valor, they're going to save. So the big question to me is always, how does it do against the top decks? If the top decks were decks like Lannister and Martell, I think it would have a better shot because it could kill off a lot of the guys. But if the top decks are going to be Maester decks, then it's not going to be able to kill the important characters anyway. So for me, it's not new cards that shaped Greyjoy Maesters. I mean, Asha is fantastic, but I don't consider her a brand new card, and she's not completely transformative. I was running the same deck at the beginning of the regional season with quite a bit of success, before I realized Martell Maester was way over the curve and switched to that. But my build would have gotten crushed by Targ because threat would kill a lot of guys. Although you have saves, they can't save people. What's really shaped this particular version, I think, is some creative thinking and bringing older cards to the fore. For instance, Risen from the Sea is an event that I used to laugh at. Why would anybody waste an event slot on a save? That's madness.
I actually remember you making fun of me when I took it to the Rochester Regional.
Exactly, and I still think it was a foolish choice. But in a Targ heavy meta, it's an amazing choice because suddenly they go to burn your guy, and not only do you save them, they get that strength boost, and so then they can't be saved.
And they get that attachment protection because there's still a bunch of burn that won't affect them if they have that attachment on them.
Exactly. And Makoro is another card who fits in that same slot as someone who is increasing the strength. So yes, he's a new card, and maybe we could say he is a reason, but I don't think you can say the one Mokoro that I run in my deck changes everything. And another idea is something else I would have scoffed at before, which is to main deck a couple of Apprentice Collars. This seemed like a crazy idea to me before, but if Targ is going to be a big deck in the meta and a lot of its burn is reliant on cards not having attachments, just dropping random Apprentice Collars on Maesters or even Asha so that she's harder to burn can be very, very useful.
It's also super useful against a lot of the Stark decks out there that are trying to blank your Maester traits. Having, you know, two Apprentice Collars on a Maester basically guarantees that you don't have to worry about blanking at that point.
Yeah, exactly, which is a really cool idea. You put a couple of Maesters, you put a couple Apprentice Collars on them, and they're thinking to themselves, oh, I got these guys, I drew a Mira, and then you put two Apprentice Collars on them, and they say, what the? Where did that come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I agree. I think that it wasn't really any one or two new cards, unlike the other decks, that brought this to the forefront. I think it was literally someone sitting down and saying, okay, this is the current meta. What plays really, really good against this meta? And they thought to themselves, they said, you know what? Greyjoy Maesters do. And a lot of people said, you know, you're crazy. And then he said, no, as long as I'm playing some of these older cards and I'm doing X and doing Y, it's going to work. Stuff like using Old Town Advisors, which a lot of people didn't use before, but, you know, that extra amount of counsel that you can put in a Greyjoy deck with those is just awesome.
Yeah, and I think they were unplayable for quite a long time because in a meta where Venomous Blade is a prevalent card, you just can't play the Old Town Advisor. You put a couple chains on him and they go, oh, he's dead. But now that nobody plays it, suddenly he's an amazing card.
Yeah, so it was the resurfacing of these older cards that really made a huge difference. I totally agree. So if you want to see some of these top-tier decks, you know, you listen to this podcast, you heard us talk, well, I think everyone's seen on Agot Cards Bruno's World Championship deck, but also the Shalik, the deck that won the European... Stalik, thank you. The deck that won Stalik is available on Agot Cards as well. I believe it's called Maesters and Commanders. And though the common Stark Winter deck is not available, the most common Stark Knight deck was posted by Derek after he won the overall championship. So all these are available for people to quite easily see on Agot Cards, and it will give you a very good sense of what's going to come in this regional season, I think, because you know, the closer we approach regional, the more and more I think we're going to see very few chapter packs for the early regional, maybe one or two. I don't see FFG coming out and allowing more than maybe two chapter packs. What do you think, Tiny?
Yeah, I'm really surprised at the long distance of time that's passed between the chapter packs being released. I mean, I've been fine with that because, like I said, there wasn't a regional coming. I wasn't going to be prepping for regional decks. I was playing Star Wars, having a lot of fun with that. But now that I think more carefully about it, it means exactly what you said. The meta is not going to change much. Unless there's some bonkers card in these first two packs, the meta is going to pretty much look exactly the same as it does now. And that's a bit scary that we could have a meta that looks identical for this long. At the same time, though, it does allow for innovation. Like, it gives that Martell player who really wants to come out with some cool new build of Martell the ability to do that, knowing that it's not just going to be blown out of the water by a bunch of new packs that are coming out.
Yeah, it really lets the players start to prep for the regional season now, because I don't think there's going to be some new card that's going to totally change the meta in the first couple chapter packs. I think FFG does a fantastic job of making most of their cards within a certain power level, and that they don't completely transform the meta with a single pack. So I think that if you start prepping now, you start building decks now, you start playing, maybe you come on Octagon, you play with some of the people on Octagon, you're going to have pretty close to what your final regional deck would be.
Yep, definitely. And if you find something that's not Targ, Stark Murder, or Greyjoy Maester, feel free to email it to us, because we're a little bit bored with the top three decks, and we would love to be able to take some cool new deck that one of our listeners sent us and bring it to a regional and crush everyone and give you some credit for your abilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, people like me stuck up in Canada, you really don't have to worry about your meta back wherever you are finding out about the deck if I take it to a regional event and play for you. And also, if I won a regional event with a deck that someone else created, I would, of course, ship most of the prizes to them.
Wow, nice. And even better, Dark Nodge likes crazy Shaga decks. If you send me a deck and it's not full of Tier 1 cards, I'm going to send it back to you and say I only play good decks. If you send Dark Nodge a deck full of crazy cards, you never know. He might be able to make it a Tier 1 deck.
Yeah, I do enjoy something that's different from the norm.
Welcome to another edition of Ask Bruno, our very favorite segment in which we ask our very favorite Game of Thrones player, John Bruno, is it 12-time world champion now, John?
Yeah, close to that, something like that.
So the 12-time reigning champion, John Bruno, has stepped in to answer a few questions tonight. John, the question I have for you tonight is, what do you think about this claim that has been going around in multiple threads that the meta has gotten stale, and not only has it gotten stale, it's gotten too big, new players can't get into the game, other new games such as Star Wars and Netrunner are siphoning off Game of Thrones players, the sky is falling, what are we supposed to do, John? Do you have an answer for us? Save us.
Sure. I think everyone who feels that way and doesn't want to play the game anymore, it's been nice knowing you. Take care. Keep in touch. I think that too many people overreact. When House of Dreams came out, everyone's like, oh my gosh, this card's so ridiculous. This card's broken. And people were ready to start complaining about that and think it should be on the restricted list, banned, whatever. Then I was like, play with it. You know, there's a lot of things I say that about, but in terms of cards, just play with it and see what happens first before you can make that point. I think right now, what happens for so many players is that all they want to do is play the same thing. It's not that the environment's stale because they have too many cards out there. Yeah, to me, that gives you more opportunity. Try different decks. I mean, I'm not trying to say the deck I played at Worlds was the most creative deck ever. But I do think there were cards I was playing in a deck that people don't. And you won't know how cards play unless you try it. That's how combos are found. That's how new deck ideas get out there. And as soon as people start seeing a new deck idea, everybody starts playing it, and that's how the environment becomes stale again. You won't know how things work until you start trying different ideas. Now, it's true that there are a lot of cards available. Okay, we have like 8 cycles of chapter packs available, along with, you know, a core set for each house, and then the original core set. So there's a lot of card, there's a huge card pull out there. And people talk about the power creep, and I've seen that happening too, where a lot more of the recent cards get played and some of the old ones don't. But at the same time, it's kind of cool when you find a deck or find a card from an old set and play with it. If you take the very first chapter pack and pull a card out of there and try something with that. I mean, it's nice to see people actually, at least a Baratheon banner, people play that card. That was in the very first chapter pack cycle. So it's just kind of cool to see people pulling out cards like that and trying those different things. Again, the problem is that when the people look at the competitive environment, they want to stick with the decks that have worked. And again, that's where creativity has died down. So that's where I think things are at.
So are you saying that it's less of a stale meta and more of chicken players who are unwilling to go out of that safety net and go out of their safe zone and find that interesting deck?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily call it chicken players. I don't think I'd call any player chicken, except when you play me, but or decide not to. I think that it's really just like I know I get this way when I start to look at thinking about building a deck. I mean, before, you know, Worlds, I was thinking about this. It's kind of like daunting. It's kind of intimidating to look at so many cards and pull the ones out that it's easy to stick to the ones you know. So maybe it's not necessarily, you know, chicken for a player to not do that. It's just they're, you know, it's more convenient to play the cards you know instead of thinking outside the box a little bit and trying some other stuff. So it is hard for new players to get into the game because of the wealth of cards that you have to buy to catch up. I don't believe that's true either, though. I mean, if you have friends in an area and you can borrow cards from them, great. Playing on Octagon, making proxies for a while, get used to them, see what cards you want. Then you want to go to a tournament, buy the cards you need, borrow the cards you need. So to play competitively in a tournament, you need legal cards, so you get those cards. But to play in any kind of regular, hey, I'm playing at home, I'm playing locally, I'm playing, you know, with a bunch of friends and everything, you can do whatever you want to do. You don't have to use a restricted disc if you don't want to. You don't have to have real cards if you don't want to. You can play with, you know, proxies and make those cards and play with those. So that's how you're going to get more creative ideas and bring people into the game by doing both of those things. And I also think that some people who've been playing this game for a long time don't take the effort to bring new people in. Instead, you know, the first time they sit down and play with them, you know, they might talk about the game. They might talk about it negatively. Oh, it's too hard to get into. You know, you need to do more things to encourage people to get into the game. You know, maybe the best thing I think actually right now is, and maybe it's not like an FFG show, but the Game of Thrones HBO card game that they made. That's perfect. I'm just going to use that as my teaching game for people now, so I can show somebody how to play the game. So you can do that, and then they get into it more. Let them borrow some of your cards. Let them go on the line, like the great sites we have, like the two best ones, Card Game DB, and they got cards. You know, they go on there, and there's the cards and the images of both of the cards, and with text and pictures, and you can go through and print your cards up and make your own proxy deck. Try it out. So, I think too many people are negative and want to look at the negative aspect of it, of the card pool and what's out there, and the trying to build decks, new decks, and they don't actually really want to put the effort in. Because we always want to complain before we actually do something.
Yeah, I've been a little surprised, actually, at not only one thread, but two threads talking about the stale meta. Maybe it's just me, and maybe it's that I'm a little bit newer to the game, but the way I look at a meta is a meta. That's just what it is. Sure, sometimes it's going to change. Sometimes it's going to change more. Sometimes it's going to change less. The meta is actually constantly changing, even if it doesn't necessarily look like it. Like what you were talking about, I can guarantee there's some people kind of under the scenes making some new interesting decks. You can look at AGOT cards and see what the Europeans are up to. For instance, their Greyjoy Maester deck basically took a deck I had left for dead and pulled it back and said, look, if I put all these different older cards in there, suddenly it's a great deck again.
Sure.
So I guess my next question for you is, what do you think of the restricted list? Do you think are there a couple of cards you think that should be added to it? Do you think it's fine how it is? Do you think we should add 200 cards to it and just shake things up? Do you have any thoughts on it?
You asked a bunch of questions. To answer your last question first, yes, I have some thoughts on it. To answer the first question, do I think that adding, or maybe this is your third question, 200 cards to this list might be a good idea to shake it up. I don't know. Or I think that I would like to see more cards go on to the restricted list. Again, if you look at the original restricted list when it came out or the explanation of it, cards are going to be there, you know, to break up combos, to break up powerful combination, not necessarily like an infinite combo or some other combos like that. Cards were going to go on there because they were in every single deck. You know, like every single, I mean, the Baratheon one, you still have a character for one turn. That's the Baratheon Fury plot. Okay? Now when they added it to, okay, at the end of the phase, that character goes back. It was strong for that turn, but in the end, it's like no more than a Horn of Dragons. And you still have to win that power challenge first. Does anybody ever play the Fury of the Martell? No. Why did they Fury of the Sun plot? No. They played it because of the great stats. 5 gold, 7 initiative. So those are great stats. So if I was going to play Martell, a lot of people might play that plot. If I was going to play the Baratheon, I might play that plot. But people, it went on the restricted list because it was in every deck. You know, I mean, the card I think I see in a lot of decks now is like Retaliation. You know, that's a plot card that a lot of people play with. It could go on the list. I mean, we knew Search and Detain would eventually go up under. It was in every single deck that everyone was making after that, unless you were devoted to a city deck or something. So I think that the way you open things up is you put cards that people play a lot and put it on a restricted list. You take Martell, for example. They have so many great events, so many great characters, and they're the ones that have had the more cards show up on the restricted list over the last year and a half. You know, Burning in the Sand, the Bannerman, the Venom's Blade, the, you know, you start taking more of their cards and putting them on there. Just because then it doesn't mean the cards are banned. And that's the thing I like about the restricted list. You can still play the card. Every card can still be played, just not in combination with other cards that make the deck super powerful. Or, in my opinion, like repetitive. It's like you sit down during regional season last year, during Gen Con, Gen Con especially, I expected to see a lot of Maesters, but regionals, tons of Maesters all over the place. I just got tired of playing against Maesters. And it's funny because I actually played Maesters at Gen Con, but I didn't at Worlds. That's why I built the Targ one, because I wanted to do something that was just totally different and more fun, and I thought could give Maesters maybe a bit of a challenge. But anyways, I would like to see a bigger restricted list. I don't think it needs to be 200 cards, but just take maybe a few from each house and throw them on there. Maybe 5, maybe 10 max, just so you can mix things up. And that's what I would like to see happen.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on what some of those cards would be? Or I guess let me rephrase that. So a card like, say, Kyle Condon. He's a hyper-efficient Stark character who goes in every single Stark deck. Do you think a character like that should be on the restricted list?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't think he would go on there. The cards I think that would go on there would be the ones that, and it seems, you know, kind of crazy to say this, but maybe cards that can win games by themselves. Like I thought for a long time that even the Red Viper, you know, a great card. But he's even better when I have all the backup of all the Martell events and all the Martell stuff they can do. So, I mean, wouldn't it be cool to see him on the list? People have complained about, you know, once my deck came out and looked at all the things you could do with it, and Long Lances. I seen a thread like that on the boards. You know, could Long Lances be on there? Sure, because you don't want to give so many powerful things. But in the future, it lets you, gives you, I think, more of a design space for our designers because they can build other versions that just won't react with current ones because they can't be played together. So, I don't know. I'd like to see, like I said, I would like to see a bigger list. I do think that will open up design space for players and for the FFG designers.
Okay, so you're thinking cards that are like big power-grabbing cards like maybe Cersei and the Red Viper, those staples of every deck that help you push through that win quick?
Sure. And even, I mean, I think other cards I'd like to see go on there. I've always felt, and I have felt this for a while, about the agendas. Some agendas are great, and some of them should go on there. Okay, here's the way I feel about agendas. I like agendas that are double-sided. They can come back and hurt you, double-edged. You know that if I'm playing the Knight's agenda, and my opponent puts out more knights, is that a possibility that could happen? If I'm playing a Stark deck, is it possible I can run up against a Baratheon deck or a Lannister deck that produces more knights? Absolutely. It could come back to bite me. If I'm playing the Lannister deck and I'm using their agenda, okay, is it possible I might lose entry challenges? Yes, and that could come back to bite me because I gave up cards or power. Okay, if I'm playing Targ and I don't get to do the extra power challenge, if I'm playing, you know, Stark and I can't do the extra military challenge. Those all have, you know, they can come back and bite you. When I'm playing Summer, that's only going to hurt me if I play Winter. If I'm playing Winter, that almost never comes back to hurt me. Mm-hmm. And so there's no like repercussions for putting Summer or Winter into your deck. If I have a, and that's another thing too. I think those two agendas specifically have hurt more, even more than maybe the Maesters. But those two for sure, because how many times do people take a deck and say, "Oh, I need card draw. Well, let's put Summer on. My deck's not doing much. Let's throw Winter on just so maybe I can pull some cards out of people's hands." I mean, there are very few decks that are built Winter based anymore, or Summer based anymore, and they're just using it for something extra to fill inefficiencies in their deck. And that's laziness too. And you get a lot of that out of the Macers too. So I mean, those three, I mean, very few times you're going to get screwed because you have the Macers path as your agenda and you didn't have an opportunity to win, you know, enough challenges to pull those chains off. So even their negative isn't that strong. So I wouldn't mind seeing, and I'm glad it's on the restricted list. So I wouldn't mind seeing agendas go under that, you know, are too one-sided or too, there's no reason not to play it.
Okay, fair enough. I think I would have to agree with that, especially winner. Winner is that one agenda that you can just throw into a deck. It has no downside. It only has a tremendous upside. And I think we've been seeing that has been a staple of those hyper-efficient Tier 1 decks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the Conclave? Do you think he should be made unique or restricted, or do you think anything should be done with him?
Well, I wouldn't say he, because the Conclave represents plural to me. But anyway, I do think the Conclave is the one card that fuels the Maester's path even more because of the speed you get out of it. And it's so easy if you're committed to playing Maesters just to throw that in. I mean, just think of the Conclave was on the restricted list. You could not play the Conclave if you were doing the Maester's Path then, since they're both on the restricted list. That right there might be a discouraging thing for people to even try the Maester's Path. So that's, I mean, to me, that's kind of good, because then you're going to try something different. I mean, you played a regional season. Didn't you just, wasn't it ridiculous the number of Maester decks out there is just boring, you know? So this way, people might, if I don't get to play the Conclave, they might say, I don't want to use the Maester's Path. You know, I mean, out of the other cards on there, look at some of the chains. I've seen on the FFG boards, somebody started a thread, should we restrict the Tin Link? You know, I saw over regional season, a lot of people were like, I don't want to play attachments because of the Maesters and the Tin Link. Well, what if now the Tin Link ended up on the restricted list? Now, if you want to play the Maester's Path, you really are truly making a Maester deck, and you're not just relying on the Conclave or, you know, the benefit you get from having the Tin Link, and other people can put attachments back in their deck. See, right there, I just created more deck types because I can play attachments now because I don't fear the Tin Link. Or I can play some other decks because I don't have to worry about that rush of the Conclave.
Yeah, I really like the idea of restricting the Conclave because I feel like it. You have to make a choice then with a Maester deck. You can either make a rushy, power-grabbing, hammer-type Maester deck in which you try to put out a bunch of little Maesters and get the big Conclave out and crush that way, or you can run more of a toolboxy version, but you can't do both. I think that's what makes Maester decks so strong, is that you both get all this challenge control, draw, attachment control, and these ridiculously huge guys practically for free.
Exactly. And I don't think it should be that way. I mean, I think I want to see a deck focused around a concept, not something that's given to you. If you want to run a breath, lame thing in there that anybody can play to make it, you know, a new deck. I mean, I want to throw a Maester in now. Now my deck covered up for the inefficiencies it had. Build those inefficiencies yourself. I mean, for me, that's what plots are for, to help you get the control back or the other things you need. You know, I definitely need this location. Okay, put it in the search plot. They let you go look for a location. Okay, I mean, yeah, you're giving your opponent something too. But, you know, if you need it that badly, you got to do that. So I'd rather see you get filling those holes by using your plots instead of using just Maesters, for example.
So, John, I like all your ideas. Is there any chance you're going to quit your job and just become a designer for FFG?
Not on the salary they pay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us this week, John, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Summer is Coming, and until next week, stay classy, Westeros.